in online advertising. Microsoft and AT&T had both complained the matchup would give Google dominance on the World Wide Web. Near today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 40 points at 13,246, NASDAQ up nearly 40 points, the S&P 500 up 7. And there's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The title of today's show is, Was Jesus God? It's a short, three-word question. It's a question that has had an enormous impact on Western civilization and world civilization. It's a question where at one time, if you gave what was considered to be the wrong answer, your very life was in peril. Was Jesus God? Or perhaps for a Christian, the more apt question would be, is Jesus God? Since a true believing Christian believes that Jesus of Nazareth has eternal life. Before I introduce my esteemed guest, who is an author and a professor of New Testament studies, I want to speak for about 10 minutes on the uniqueness of my topic today and why I'm even raising it on a political talk show 5 days before Christmas. And to compensate for these minutes and to recognize the specialness of today's show, I'm going to do the entire show today without commercial break. At its simplest level, I'm discussing this topic because I can, because I proudly live in a free country where it's a highly unusual exception to most historical times and places, but today, in America, a Jew and a Christian are free to openly discuss the differences in their religious beliefs without fear of pain or persecution. I'm also raising this topic because, as most of you know, I recently invited my rabbi to appear on the Inside Scoop to discuss his particular brand of Jewish thought, and all of you so incredibly well received him. I want to thank all of you for the many dozens of emails that you wrote me telling me how much you enjoyed that show. But I also raised this topic on a political show because most recently, front-running Republican candidates for president, Mike Huckabee, Mitt Romney, even to some extent John McCain, they have put forward their faith in the divinity of Jesus to the voters, despite the fact that the Constitution emphatically forbids any religious test from ever being required as a qualification for holding office in the United States. Huckabee and Romney, at least, in great contrast to John F. Kennedy, they profoundly believe that their religious belief, their particular belief in the divinity of Jesus, it's relevant to their run for president, and heck, it's a great way to garner votes from the growing evangelical Christian community in the United States. Now, as an American, I find that profoundly disturbing. As a Jew, doubly so. And yet, I'm someone who's always loved learning. I've never shied away from asking myself and others difficult, profound questions. I love history, philosophy, and as a religious person, the early foundations of Christianity, its break from Judaism, they've always fascinated me. The historical Jesus is someone I've found to always be an interesting character. And I should say at the outset, I have a lot of respect for him, although I do not think him divine. I mean, look, here we have Christianity, the largest religion in the world. It's not a majority of the world's populations, but it's larger than any other religion. And it's about to celebrate Christmas in 5 days. And a Merry Christmas to you all, I should add. But I can't help but notice that its mother religion, my religion, Judaism, is one of the smallest in the world. In fact, after the Holocaust, there are fewer Jews today than there were in the 1930s. One out of three Jews were murdered. And so the fact that the largest world religion was born of one of the smallest, and that it worships as God incarnate, this Jewish guy from Judea, it's a very interesting thing, don't you think? I mean, I can't challenge other world religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Shintoism, animism. They have their religious texts. They accept them on faith. I don't accept them on faith. Conversation over, right? But Christianity is unique. it has this strange relationship with Judaism. It has appropriated the entire Hebrew Bible and calls it its own, quote, Old Testament, unquote. Christianity doesn't make claims just as a religion, separate apart from other religions, apart from Judaism. It claims this Jewish guy, Jesus, to be the Jewish Messiah, in addition to being God himself and the Son of God. So unlike most religious faiths where I can just say, well, you believe what you want to believe, I as a Jew can challenge Christianity, can even question it. Not on the basis of faith. No one can challenge someone's faith. Not on the basis of the New Testament, really. I mean, my guest, I'm sure, accepts that as Holy Writ, and I consider it interesting stories by people who had an agenda. And like most ancient stories, mix the literal truth with their own agenda. No, I as a Jew can challenge Christianity because I can ask whether this claim that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah and was also God legitimately and logically arises from the Hebrew Bible. Now, let me be clear before I invite my guest. It's not a challenge I undertake lightly. In the Middle Ages, Jews were often forced by kings and popes to defend their religion against the claims of Christianity, and virtually always these disputations were followed by brutal persecutions. I should tell you that many people, Jews and Christians, have warned me not to even broach this topic for fear of offending people. So I want to be clear just at the outset, which is why I'm going on at length. It is not my goal or purpose to offend anybody. I fully recognize, I've often said on my show, I judge people by their deeds, not by their faith. And my religion teaches that all good people have a place in the hereafter, in the world to come. So please don't see today's discussion as some presumptuous attempt on my part to convert anybody. My religion does not missionize. And if you think you may be offended by challenges to your religious faith, by me or my guest, then please, you know, turn off your radio, stop the podcast, turn off the computer. Because if your religious beliefs work for you and you're not harming anybody else, that's terrific. Go about your way. Go do positive things in the world. I don't want to challenge a faith that sustains people. But for those of you that are intellectually curious, whatever religious faith or lack of religious faith you have, just to understand the Inside Scoop, we've always challenged accepted wisdom, whether it's the news the government doesn't want you to know or news the mainstream media doesn't report. From the time I wrote on the Supreme Court decision from Bush v. Gore to today, I've always wanted to show when I believe the emperor had no clothes. And in this case, I do audaciously challenge the accepted wisdom of billions of people on earth who believe Jesus to be God. And I do so with tremendous respect for the many wonderful Christians and people of all religions who do so much good on earth, and with great horror at the terrible Christians and people of all religions who've done evil on earth. This isn't about individual acts. It's about the question of whether the historical Jesus was divine. And as I said, the question of Jesus' divinity is a profound question of Western civilization. It's one of the most important and consequential questions in human history. And heck, I've never run away from attacking hard questions. And neither has my guest, Dr. Daryl Bach. Dr. Bach is a past president of the Evangelical Theological Society and an editor for Christianity Today. He is a research professor of New Testament studies at the Dallas Theological Seminary and a professor for spiritual development and culture at the seminary's Center for Christian Leadership. His new book, Dethroning Jesus, Exposing Popular Culture's Quest to Unseat the Biblical Christ, is on the New York Times bestseller list. Dr. Bach, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Pleasure to hear you today, and let me wish you Happy Hanukkah before we go any further.
Well, thank you, and a Merry Christmas to you.
Thanks.
Let me start with one of the people that I've been reading a lot of lately, and I know you have too, and it's largely part of your book, and that is Dr. Bart Ehrman. Dr. Bart Ehrman, as you know, as many of my listeners know, is someone who grew up very strongly in your faith. Currently, he's an agnostic. But he says that the reason he became one was because of his very detailed study of the original writings of the New Testament, of the original Gospels. You, of course, take issue with Dr. Ehrman.
Yes, I do, because I think that study and the points that he makes in many of his books, in fact, even though some of the facts that he points to are accurate, the actual implications that he draws from them are non sequiturs and really don't follow. And so I think he has gone beyond what the evidence actually shows.
Well, let's go through that and explain to me how that is. What Dr. Ehrman has brought out is that the Gospels were not written contemporaneously with the time of Jesus. They were written 30, 40, sometimes 60 or 100 years later in the case of John.
We've always said that, so that's not anything new.
Right. It's not new. And frankly, anyone who studied Christianity should know that fact. And he points out that the differences among the various gospel accounts, and points out that the authors had an agenda, and their agenda was to proclaim their gospel, to proclaim their belief in their religion, and therefore that we can't necessarily take every word in the gospels as literal truth. Do you take every word in the gospels as literal truth?
Not in the sense in which you asked the question. What I would say is yes, these people did have an agenda. They were profoundly impacted by an experience that they had that had turned them from being strictly Jewish into being Jewish Christian, if I can use that phrase, for the first century. And that's no different than Moses having an agenda when he writes the Pentateuch. I mean, in one sense, religious claims are about a discussion and description of what God is doing in the world, and that has an agenda that always comes with it. So I don't think that disqualifies a religious text or a religious claim from presenting itself to someone and from them having then to make an evaluation about what is in front of them.
Well, let me just briefly agree with you that I think all the prophets of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, had an agenda. Of course they did. And their various agendas is written in those books. So I don't deny that at all. But how can you tell what is historically true and what is theologically true? I'm really not out to argue theology here per se. I mean, you know, we can all have faith in all kinds of things. But in terms of the historical Jesus, you have different accounts. I mean, Matthew says things happened one way. Mark says it happened slightly differently. Luke has a different account. And John's account is altogether very strikingly different from the other three. How do you accept the truth of accounts that are contradictory?
Well, I don't buy that they're contradictory. I prefer that they're more complementary and that there are relationships between these accounts that show that they are dealing with questions from different perspectives. What people do is they fall into a formula, and that formula is difference equals contradiction. Well, that doesn't necessarily follow at all. You've got the same kinds of differences operating within the Hebrew scriptures and many texts. And the question becomes, what's the relationship between these texts? And it's not always one of contradiction. Now, I realize that there are people, good Christian people, across the map in terms of how they handle the Scripture, and some people think that the Scripture has problems and contradictions at certain points. I mean, the whole other layer of the question is, let's assume that there were some contradictions in the text. Does that mean that they got the basic story of who Jesus was and the presentation of who Jesus was completely wrong? Those two things don't necessarily follow either. And so that what you get in discussion about the nature of the Bible in the New Testament is a spectrum of presentations of various views about how to work with this material. You ask the question, how do you know that a certain thing is historical versus being theology, which in itself poses the question, are history and theology necessarily opposed to one another? Is it the case that when I'm being theological, am I necessarily being non-historical? Again, the answer to that question is not necessarily. So this leads us into a very complex but a very careful process in which people try to sort out those elements. When do history and theology track together? When might they be tracking on a different track? Those kinds of things. And that's why you get the spectrum that you do of opinion, and then I think it's down to helping people sort through what's possible. A lot of people reject what's in the Bible because they don't believe that God acts in the very ways in which the Bible describes God as acting. So they're automatically put in the position of having to reject some of the Bible because they don't think certain things can happen. Well, that's different than many people of faith, and here I'm talking about Jewish faith and or Christianity, who believe that God can act in certain ways and who accept accept what the text says as being possible, and that renders a different kind of judgment in and of itself. This is where we talk about sometimes worldview or presuppositions or pre-understanding, whatever term you want to label it with. So all these factors come into assessing how the Bible works, what the Bible is, what the Bible presents, whether it's metaphor, theology, history, and those are distinct, or whether those things all belong together.
Do you consider the Bible to be literally true, having been replicated without error from the time of Jesus?
Well, let me say it this way. I think that the Bible is sufficiently true and sufficiently clear, even in the variation of wordings between the accounts, because I spend my professional career working in the Gospels, that it gives an accurate reflection of who Jesus is. That's really the point, I think, to understand about the Bible. Christians, for a long time, goes back as far as Augustine and even earlier, in the 5th century and earlier, recognized that there were differences in the wording between the accounts, but that didn't necessarily disqualify these texts from giving us a historical portrait of who Jesus was.
Okay, and let me say at the outset that I personally have no doubt that a man by the name of Jesus existed. And in fact, some of the things that are attributed to him in the Gospels I find quite inspiring. My difficulty, and indeed the Jewish difficulty with Jesus, was not that a man existed, of course, but that indeed he was God. And one of the things that I find interesting, you know, I open up the New Testament and I see the very first Gospel that's written there is Matthew. And I see the very first verse of the very first chapter in the Gospel according to Matthew. And in that first verse, going down throughout the first chapter, whoever wrote the Gospel according to Matthew is very clear to say that Joseph, Mary's husband, if you will, is a descendant of King David. Now, I understand why that might be. It was very important for the original concept of the Jewish Messiah to have a descendant of David. David was the greatest king, and it was foretold that the Messiah would be another king who would rule over Israel just like King David and bring it back to its time of glory. And so it was understood that it would be the son of the son of the son of the son of King David. And yet, in the very first book of Matthew, it goes through and says that Joseph was a descendant of King David. Now, if Joseph was Jesus' father, well, then that makes sense. Then they're trying to argue that Jesus is a Messiah in the Davidic line. I get that. But if God is Jesus' father, which I think is a very different concept, why the heck does Matthew spend all of chapter 1 talking about Joseph?
Well, in fact, Matthew's more complicated than you've suggested, because if you look at that genealogy very carefully in the Greek, what you will see is that when you get to verse 16 of chapter 1, it does say, and Jacob was born of Joseph, and then it goes on to say, the husband of Mary, and then it does something very interesting. It says, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ. Only when it says, of whom Jesus was born, it goes to a feminine rather than a masculine, which means that the birth of Jesus is being connected to Mary in the laying out of this genealogy, as opposed to being connected to Joseph. And so it's not the case that the genealogy itself is claiming that Jesus is the biological child of Joseph. What the genealogy is actually claiming is that Mary is married to Joseph and is part of a family that in which the biological connection is associated with Mary in terms of where the origin is coming from, but the social connection is tied to Joseph because of her relationship to Joseph.
So why is it relevant that Joseph, who is not, according to Christianity, biologically related to Jesus, why is it relevant whether he is a descendant of King David or not? And furthermore, how can Jesus be the Messiah if he is not a biological descendant of King David?
Well, there are really two answers to this question. One is that it's relevant because if Joseph socially is connected to David, then Jesus is still socially connected to Joseph as a descendant of David. The more perhaps important question that you're raising is whether or not Mary also is in the line of David and thus could be reflected of the line of David. And that's something the early church has also claimed.
But that's not in the New Testament.
No, actually, that's part of what's being suggested in here is that there is this dual relationship that exists. It's kind of which no matter which road you go down, it points back to David.
Right, but it always comes from Joseph, never from Mary. I mean, whether you look in Luke or you look in Matthew,
well, I think I tried to explain that what's going on here in Matthew is actually a claim that ties the biology, at least to a certain degree, back to Mary. By the way, the grammar is very explicit in switching from what would normally be a male set of relationships to a female connection in verse 16 of chapter 1.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the New Testament does not claim in Matthew or Luke or anywhere, to my knowledge, maybe you know somewhere else, does not claim Mary to be a descendant of David. I mean, it claims that Joseph was a descendant of David.
It does claim that Joseph is a descendant of David, and it also, there's discussion. Another issue that's a part of this discussion is how Luke's genealogy, which is slightly different, by the way, than Matthew's, ties into all this, and whether or not, in fact, we've got two lines being represented, one being the female line and one being the male line, and again, whether both of these lines end up coming up. So the idea that there is no claim in the New Testament that Mary goes back to David is not at all, let's say it this way, it's not clear that that is not part of at least some of what the New Testament claims.
Okay, I mean, I got my Bible out here, and I brought it out specifically for this discussion, and I've turned to Luke 3:23,
mm-hmm.
and Luke 3:23 also says that it says in my translation, Jesus being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph the son of Heli, the son of all the way back to David, and then all the way back to Adam.
And
so,
you can see this tension in the laying out of the genealogy in the way both genealogies are set forth. In the Matthew genealogy, we've got this feminine connection that's highlighted, by the way. Again, this is something you wouldn't see in English because you don't see gender in relative pronouns in our English, but you can see it in Greek. And then, and the same is true here in the Luke genealogy where it says, as was supposed. So there is this social legal line which Jesus has because he's in Joseph's house. Okay, on the one hand, and then there is this other line that is coming through the biology, and so that's part of what's going on here. But I'm not trying to be difficult here. I'm trying to explain what's going on. This is very much a discussed point about how the genealogies work and how you can trace the genealogy back and how Jesus could claim the Davidic sonship and the Davidic line and that kind of thing. That is part of what has been involved in the discussion.
Let me suggest to you an alternative explanation, and it's one that I believe to be true and I think makes more logical sense, and I'll obviously hear your response to it. And that is that Christianity, as it has evolved, and it has certainly changed from the time of its very early birth, probably as we know it, of course, even Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, all of that, pretty much came from the Council of Nicaea in 325. The Jewish Christians, which you mentioned, which did exist for some three centuries, were not accepted by either early Christians or the Jews, frankly, people who wanted to accept Jewish law and also practice Christianity. But let me suggest that Christianity has a tension, and the tension is between this very Jewish concept of a Messiah, of a descendant of King David, of the son of the son of the son of King David, who's going to rule over a revived Israel, and then later on in other prophetic accounts suggests, rule even more broadly as king of the world. And this idea of Jesus as divine, as the son of God. And I would suggest to you that the reason why Matthew and Luke go through Joseph is because that's the way it was done. They didn't have female kings of Israel. Not that that's right, but they just didn't. And it went son of the son of the son of the son. And they went to Joseph by these early accounts because they wanted to show he was the Messiah. And then later on came this idea that he's the son of God. And there was really a contradiction between these two ideas because you can't have a Messiah that's a divine in all the Jewish concepts of Messiah. It was a human being. It was certainly a very exalted human being, but this was a man, a son of man, a person. And therefore, the accounts of the genealogy going through Joseph are really one idea, but the accounts of Jesus as divine are another idea. And you can't graft these two together because there is no social relationship in the Old Testament. The idea is it's a son of the son of King David.
Well, no, I'm not sure I agree with you that there is no social relationship in the New Testament, and I could also challenge whether, in fact, there's never been someone who's functioned as a queen in Israel, because in the intertestamental period, you did have this short period where this happened with Alexander Salom. Let me actually state your question more pointedly, because I think it can be stated more pointedly, your objection. And that is that actually the real tension with Judaism, between Christianity and Judaism, has always been the idea that God willingly shared his glory with someone who also at the same time was a human being. This is where the tension exists between Judaism and Christianity, because, of course, in Judaism you have the Shema, which is recited in the synagogues weekly, with regard to the idea that God is only one. And
strict monotheism.
Exactly right, with the implication that comes with it oftentimes being that he shares his glory with no one. And so this counterclaim that is associated with Jesus and his person is something that ran into this, the strict monotheism of Judaism. Now, in fact, the situation is, again, more complex, because in the first century, when Jesus appears, there are discussions going on of a very second major heavenly figure who exists. This goes back to the idea of the Son of Man. It's in Jewish works associated with 1st Enoch and 4th Ezra. These are, and 3rd Enoch, there are discussions about whether Enoch could have sat at the right hand of God. There are discussions about whether Metatron can be called the lesser Yahweh or not. And so so this strict monotheism, with which there is certainly a there is a presence of the strict monotheism in Judaism and in the Judaism of the first century, is also under some pressure from other types of Jewish movements that aren't Christian but are still Jewish, in which the possibility of a second major figure operating alongside God, this doctrine is called the two powers of in heaven doctrine, whether or not that was being entertained by some Jews. So,
By the way, just to be clear, I'm not saying it wasn't entertained by some Jews, but it wasn't accepted in the canon of the Old Testament. These are apocryphal works.
Fair enough.
Enoch,
it was very much discussed. It was very much discussed in the period of, well, among certain Jewish groups.
No question about it.
Ultimately, in terms of the Jewish canon, you're absolutely correct. And so we're now into similar discussions with reference to Judaism. And when the canon was determined and named, vis-a-vis the kinds of discussions that you sometimes see with reference to Christianity, and whether the New Testament canon was a later product or not. At the Essene community, you know, texts like we see at 1st Enoch are very much in play. These are 1st and 2nd century Jewish texts. So the point is that within Jewish communities, some of these issues were being discussed. Now, I absolutely agree with you in terms of classic Orthodox Judaism, okay, these ideas would be very, very difficult and not well received. Absolutely.
And I agree with you, by the way, that these were definitely, there was a wide variety of opinion. This was a very interesting time philosophically for Judaism.
Very fluid
period, exactly. There were Hellenists, the Greeks were there, and they had a lot of interesting ideas. And the Jews were divided pretty much between Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes, and then a lot of them were Hellenized Greeks, and you throw four philosophies in the mix, and you get all kinds of interesting ideas. And
exactly right. I mean, it's a
and I think Christianity came out of three of them, actually, myself personally.
I think we may well agree on that. I mean, I think that the point here is that Judaism was struggling as a result of the influence of Alexander in the Greco-Roman world, as well as the experience that they had gone through in the Maccabean period, which, of course, is part of what Hanukkah is all about.
Right.
I tell my students that you have to appreciate how important the Maccabean period is for Judaism. We would not have Judaism today as we have it if the Jewish people had not survived the Maccabean threat, in the Maccabean period. And so this is a terrifically important time, not only for Judaism, but also for the roots and what happened in Christianity, because you had Judaism responding in a variety of ways to how do I deal with the Hellenistic world that literally surrounds me? And of course, that produced all the differences and the tensions within Judaism, etc. All of that to say that what we have going on between Christianity and Judaism from the very first century, from the very earliest roots of these texts, is a discussion about the nature of divine authority. And that's part of what makes this period so incredibly fascinating. Now, my gripe, if I can say it that way, about Bart Ehrman, just to kind of come full circle, about Bart Ehrman and some of the people who are trying to redefine and redescribe Christianity, my gripe with them is that I don't think their portrait of the early Christian period is actually historically accurate. I would prefer.
Where is he inaccurate?
Well, it's inaccurate. It's inaccurate at several levels. One, it's inaccurate in the suggestion that the text that we have in the New Testament, as Bart Ehrman has suggested in misquoting Jesus, has been copied so sloppily that we don't actually know it was originally there. That's one element. It's inaccurate in the suggestion that these extra-biblical gospels, which are actually, in most cases, heavily influenced by Gnosticism, would have ever been acceptable to an original movement that did emerge out of Judaism, where God, the Creator, was a good God who created a good creation. In these Gnostic texts, we have an underling God who's an evil God who creates an evil creation at the beginning. So someone coming out of Judaism, embracing Genesis 1, or embracing the Psalms, would be inherently, resistant to the idea that God, the top God, didn't create. He has nothing to do with the creation, and that the creation that we have is an absolute corruption from the very beginning. That's an offense.
And Dr. Buck, I agree with you on that Gnostic point, except that I would argue that Christianity has accepted some of those principles with the whole glorification is the right word. In fact, it's the wrong word. But let's say the heavy emphasis on Satan, which has very little emphasis in Jewish texts, but because of Zoroastrianism and other dual-type religions, good versus evil, Christianity very much took the idea of the devil and ran with it, far more so than Judaism. And that comes from these Gnostic traditions, doesn't it?
Well, no, I don't think it's quite that simple, again, because what's happened here is, and again, this part of this depends on when we're talking. Part of this depends on, say, when do you date a book like Job? And part of it depends on how do you count the Qumran community, very conservative Jewish community that obviously spent a lot of time thinking about the role of Satan. What do you do with this intertestamental literature that is, or Second Temple literature that is reflecting on the Old Testament and has developed alongside what is going on in the Old Testament canon, traditions associated with the role of evil in the world, some of which have been absorbed in aspects of the Talmudic tradition. Judaism itself is quite complex on these matters in this period, and this is part of why this is a mistake actually that happens in the historical discussion with both Christianity and Judaism. This is why I so appreciate getting the time to talk about this. What often happens is that we have brought an impression of what Judaism is or what Christianity is, often based upon the orthodoxies that we experience in our own time, without having an appreciation for how complex the religious discussion was in the first century, and thus for the kinds of things they were discussing back then.
Let me say, I agree with you, and I'm very glad that we can agree on so much, frankly, in this discussion, just about what is happening in history. Let me go back, though, to the question that I guess I was trying maybe inadequately to get to with the question of the genealogy in Matthew. Just the basic point. The Jewish concept of the Messiah was it was a human being. There was no divine aspect to the Messiah. It was, you know, he was a king. He was a Mashiach in Hebrew means anointed one, because you pour oil over the king. And this, the idea was King David was a terrific king. He was the most powerful, most wonderful king in Jewish history, and that his line would be restored. And that was where the whole idea of the Messiah started. Now, it changed throughout Jewish history and became much more of a metaphysical thing. I don't deny that. But it was never understood to be a god, the Messiah, but a king. And, of course, Jesus is taught under Christian theology, which ostensibly comes from this Jewish theology, that Jesus is God. And, of course, he never was actually a king in the sense that we think of an earthly king like King David. So how do you ascribe the differences between this original concept of the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, and the Christian idea of the Messiah?
Well, it would be 2 points. One is that the portrait of the Messiah doesn't stop with where the idea starts. It also gets developed throughout the Old Testament so that it gets connected to, at least in some circles, the image of the Son of Man, who's in Daniel is a messianic-like figure who represents the people of God on the one hand, but also appears to be, personalized and particular rule and ruler. So, and that's a more transcendent picture. This Son of Man rides the clouds. And in the Old Testament, if you rode the clouds, you were a transcendent figure. You were not merely a human being.
So well, but Elijah rode the clouds, too. I mean, just for a second.
Sorry?
Elijah was brought up to heaven, but
well,
no one
Elijah,
claims that Elijah was
God. Elijah was taken up in a cloud. This is a difference. Taken up in a cloud, which actually represents the divine presence. That's part of what that symbolism represents. So the point here is that we have a picture of a human being, and remember that part of what's being claimed here is that Jesus is not just divine. He is this incarnation. This is divinity taking on flesh. And so he has this human element, which connects to the David promise that you see the New Testament sometimes highlighting, as well as this divine element, which is usually summarized in titles like Son of God or Son of Man, which is emphasizing more the divinity aspects and the nature of his authority and his authoritative claims. Now, granted, this was a fairly fresh concept in Jewish thinking at the time when Jesus is making these claims and his disciples are making these claims as having come out of Judaism. There's no doubt about that. How do they do it? Well, that's part of what the point of the Gospels is about. Part of the point of the Gospels is about that Jesus, in the work that he does and in the things that he is demonstrating, not just what he's teaching about a human being's relationship to God, but what he's doing in terms of his own presentation of his own authority and his own actions, represents the presence of the kingdom of God or the rule of God on earth and the authority to do certain things that God has given him, with these acts standing behind them saying he has the right to do these things, and they are the demonstration of the fact that he carries this authority. And of course, this led to the debate between the Jewish leadership and Jesus and his followers about who he was, because the claim then became, you're basically down to two options. On the one hand, the claim became, well, he's doing this by a transcendent power, but that power is evil. So he does this by the power of Beelzebul. This is a claim that we see in the New Testament. It's a claim that the church fathers talk about coming from Jewish Israel's, and it's a claim.
Yeah, I don't know of any Jews who claim that,
but it's in the Talmud,
okay,
as well. Okay, that Jesus is basically a sorcerer. That's the way the charge is formed, and then the other option is that yes, this is a transcendent power, but it's a positive transcendent power. So
if he's just a guy? What if he's just a Jewish guy in Judea who sees some things wrong, who's kind of mad at the temple cult for taking over and for focusing on sacrifices instead of how people were treating each other? In other words, the same kind of arguments that the Pharisees were making, people like Hillel were making. And he gets mad and he preaches, and he's caught by the Romans, as so many Jewish leaders were at that time. A later claimed Messiah, Bar Kokhba, led a whole revolt against the Romans.
Absolutely.
And was crucified, as so many people were in that era. How is it that this idea that he is either the Messiah or divine, where does that come from? And, I mean, I understand where it
that's
comes from in the New
that's
Testament.
That is the, how do I say this, the $100 million question? I mean,
well, there you go. That's why
that's
I have you here to answer
that's
those questions.
That's a great question. It's more than $64,000, okay?
Fair enough. I agree. It's a very important question.
The issue that you have to explain is, why is it that Jewish people who walked and talked with Jesus ended up adopting a view that elevated him to this kind of high level when they came out of Judaism, and when there were these other models for how to make this kind of a claim? It isn't that there wasn't a category of religious reformer, and it isn't that there wasn't a category of political reformer out there that couldn't have been adopted, but these people seem to have become convinced for one reason or another that this was an exceptional claim, a claim so exceptional that it actually produced, for lack of a better description, alterations in the way we should think about religious faith. I mean,
except the embarrassing historical fact is that most Jews rejected him. Now, there have been messianic claims throughout Jewish history. As I said, Bar Kokhba was called the Messiah. Indeed, King Cyrus of Persia, who allowed the Jews to go back after the Babylon exile, was called Mashiach.
Not claims to this level. You know,
well, sure, Shabbatai Ben Tzvi back in the 17th century was claimed to be a Messiah and a divine-like person until he converted to Islam, which kind of took the wind out of his sails. Bar Kokhba was definitely considered the Messiah, and that was just 100 years after Jesus. So this is something that's happened before.
But this was primarily a political reform claim, okay? Now, what we're talking about Jesus is a kind of unique claim that's more than politics. And so the question becomes, how is it that some Jewish people, aware of all the Jewish background that we've been discussing, okay, they're aware of all the Jewish background, their roots are in that belief, okay, how is it that they became convinced that it was okay to try and present Jesus in this new light? And so that, it is the genesis of that historical idea, which, by the way, no one can deny is part of what Christianity has claimed. That is a part of the historical DNA of Christianity.
It is. I guess, Dr. Bach, I don't know. I know lots of Jews, and we have an expression, two Jews have three opinions. The fact that Jews disagree on things, whether who is God or who's the Messiah or whatever, you could argue it's part of our tradition. I mean, we have disagreements throughout Jewish history on everything from the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes to those that supported the Greeks in the Maccabean Wars, all the way up to conservative Orthodox and Reform today, whether the Talmud should be accepted. There's been plenty of disagreement among Jews among a huge number of topics. This was a group of Jews that, yes, it accepted Jesus' claims. The majority did not. That's not unusual in Jewish history. You can't say that just because if some Jews, a minority, accepted his claims, that somehow proves he's divine.
No, I absolutely accept that. I think but I do think that the interesting observation to make here is, how is it that people who came out of a Jewish background, who were instructed in the very kind of monotheism that we've been discussing, could feel comfortable proclaiming something about Jesus they would have been absolutely unwilling to proclaim about any other individual who's ever been born? That's the question.
Well, wait, okay. Proclaiming what? That he's the Messiah or that he's God?
No, in this case, we're talking about the claim associated with the divinity, the idea that he has ascended and is at the right hand of the Father, the constellation of ideas that are associated with where Jesus is as a result of his physical resurrection. That's
And you believe the historical Jesus claimed to be God?
I think the historical Jesus claimed to be God, and he claimed an authority that he shared indivisibly with the Father. Let me say it that way.
Well, just to be clear, because all the prophets claim authority from God, Jeremiah, Isaiah, you name them, God saith unto them, and they are speaking to the people. That's very common throughout Jewish history.
Yes, but they don't
claim to have authority from God is different from claiming to be God.
No, well, except when you claim that God is going to have you sit at his right hand in heaven. Or except when you sit there and say, I have the right to forgive sins. In other words, there were certain things that Jesus was claiming that were prerogatives of the divine. That's why he got the reaction that he did in certain passages. Now, the way some people try and handle this is to say, this isn't what Jesus claimed, this is what his followers claimed about him.
Exactly.
Okay? And they try and create the divide between the historical Jesus and the Jesus as he's portrayed in the Gospels. What I'm saying to you is, I don't buy the fact that the responsibility for that comes from Jesus' followers. I think the evidence, and I spent a year writing a monograph on one scene in the New Testament. It is the scene where Jesus appears before the Jewish leadership, the Sanhedrin, before he goes on to Pilate, and he's accused of blasphemy by the leadership. On perfectly logical grounds, if Jesus is not who he claims to be, okay? So I understand the nature of the charge. In fact, part of the goal of the monograph was to study how blasphemy was viewed throughout the history of Judaism and how exaltation was viewed throughout the history of Judaism. Because basically what you had is you had a claim of exaltation running smack dab into a view of blasphemy at that trial. And my point was, if we're going to understand the history of the discussion between Judaism and Christianity, then it's very important we understand the nature of what the actual issues are and were between the two faiths. Not as a matter of of shaking your finger at someone, but just as a matter of understanding. And,
well,
and
let me
so,
suggest to you that, that the difference is that, you know, I mean, it's, I don't mean to oversimplify this, but Christians accept the New Testament as holy writ, as gospel, as truth. And so they use examples from the New Testament, and Jews don't. So Jews are looking,
well,
when they're trying to figure out who's the Messiah.
That's only part of the picture, Mark. I think the next question is, and this is where we were probably about a half an hour ago. We were saying some people say there can be problems and contradictions, but that doesn't mean that the whole story is misleading. The arguments that I tried to make in my monograph had nothing to do with the claim about whether the New Testament was the Word of God. It had to do with a strict historical inquiry into how do we get back to what happened here. Okay, is there any way to know what happened in that scene? I mean, it starts with questions like that. And is this consistent with what we see in Jesus' ministry and the way it's being portrayed, both within the Christian tradition and within the Jewish tradition's reaction to Jesus, that we have not only from the biblical materials, but from the extra-biblical materials? And
well,
so
what extra-biblical materials do we have that are contemporaneous with Jesus that talk about him? I don't know of any.
Well, we have
there were oral traditions after he died that were passed on for several decades and then were written down probably in Mark's earliest book.
We have a little sliver from the first century that comes from Josephus that talks about how the Jewish leadership passed Jesus on to Pilate. So you have that. We have the tradition that runs.
But most scholars believe that was an interpolation, that little part.
No. What most scholars actually believe is that there are certain sections of that passage that are interpolations, but that the whole thing is not an interpolation. So that, I mean, that may have been what you've heard, but in fact, there are three portions of that Josephus text that most people regard on both sides of the discussion couldn't have gone back to Josephus. Josephus would have never said that as a Jew. But there are other parts.
I've heard from most historical scholars that they even have texts without those interpolations in them, and so they're pretty clearly added by some well-meaning Christian later on.
Yeah, and that's something that I actually accept about that text, but there's a portion of that text that looks like it goes back to Josephus. Anyway, the point being here that what we are talking about is a historically investigative process that's trying to use materials on both sides. It is dealing with the traditions that we see popping up in the Talmud and that we also see corroborated in the way second century Christians are debating with Jews about what it is Jews are saying about Jesus, and there's a consistency in that material.
Can I ask you about the virgin birth?
Sure. I mean, you've asked me everything else.
Well, no, I want to get on to sort of different aspects of this. I don't want, you know, the hours flying by. The virgin birth is always something that's really interested me because I know from studying Greek and Roman historical texts, there is the story of, I believe it was Atticus, who was the god who, died and was resurrected 3 days later, and the blood of this god was used to cure sins. And to me, that just flows right into the Jesus story, and none of that do I see in the Hebrew scripture. I don't see anything about a virgin. I certainly don't buy the idea that the one passage in Isaiah referring to a young woman, which, you know, the same word Alma that's used throughout the Old Testament to describe young women, including young women giving birth, that's somehow a virgin, and they did use the word virgin for some reason, and that's the connection. I mean, it seems to me that the most likely connection is that Christianity mixed these Jewish concepts with these Roman and these Greek concepts and came together as one.
Well, again, I'm really not aware of any Greco-Roman tradition that suggests that there was a resurrection after 3 days or whatever. We do have mystery religion traditions in which, in one case, a body is cut up, it's put back together, and when it's raised, okay, this is all it can do. The little finger can move, okay, and hair grows. Okay, now that's not my concept of a resurrection, at least as Jews conceived of it, a bodily resurrection as Jews conceived of it. And to me, Christianity's concept of resurrection is coming out of Judaism. It's coming out of texts like 2nd and 4th Maccabees where people are being persecuted and they're actually being mutilated and they're saying, you can go ahead and cut up my body because God's going to give it back to me one day. So, So you've
but,
got.
But what the, about the virgin birth? Where does
okay,
that?
Okay, now the virgin birth. Let me. There are a couple of traditions associating the birth of great military rulers, Alexander the Great on the one hand, and Augustus on the other, that are associated with a kind of divine human birth. The way these
right.
are portrayed in the Greco-Roman text is of a very physical kind of act between the gods and the woman in question. I mean, it involves serpents in the description, etc. So in my mind, I look at this and I go, this is a very different kind of crass description of the way this divine human relationship works. And the other important thing to realize about
well, I was going
to
say, maybe Christianity combined them. I mean, you don't have to say that Christianity took this idea,
Let me give you the second factor
yeah.
that's important here. The second factor yeah. that's important here is that even when we get this Son of God, this Son of God is portrayed in Greco-Roman thought as being at the bottom of the heavenly ladder. In other words, those who are truly and completely, if I can say it, snow white, 100% pure gods, were at the top of the ladder, and then these Caesar gods or these ruler gods would be at the bottom of the ladder, okay? That's not what you have. That's not what you have in the Christian claim. You have a claim that this figure is literally at the side of God. So,
where is the virgin birth in Jewish thought? Is that from Isaiah 7:14? Is there something?
I actually think that the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14 is not a strictly prophetic text about the virgin birth. I actually think it is what I call a typological text. It's about an act that happened in the time of Isaiah, which itself
right.
gets replicated later on in a more exaggerated form with Jesus. So that's how I see
Do you think that the virgin birth is a Jewish concept at all? I mean, or are you agreeing with me that this is a non-Jewish concept?
Well, I think by the time you're getting to the first century, that question's becoming more complicated because of all the reasons that we've suggested through the hour. All these images that are being pushed in a more transcendent direction all the time. And so I think by the time you're getting to the first century, what might have been very difficult for a Jewish person, say, in the time of Moses or maybe even in the time of David to consider is now very possible for a first century Jewish person to consider.
Can I ask you a question? What's your view about Jesus' brothers and sisters? In the Gospels, they say he had brothers and sisters.
Is that what you're asking? Yes, I absolutely think he had family. I don't believe in the perpetual virginity of Mary, if that's what you're asking me.
Okay, all right. I'm just curious because the brothers and sisters don't seem to have written, Gospels of their own. We don't hear much about them, but they are mentioned.
Well, I don't know.
I just never seem to see, I don't see that much of it in contemporary Christianity, and that's why I'm always curious about that. We actually hear
from James, who is a brother of Jesus, that he became
right.
the leader of the Jerusalem church. So we do hear something about some of the, and this is part of what's so unusual. I mean, there are certain things that are unusual about Christianity that I think show that the tradition hasn't been trumped up. Because if you trumped up the tradition, to me, what you would do is the family would be, swarming to Jesus, and they'd be, and his family would be leaders everywhere. Well, you don't see that in the tradition.
No, in fact, I thought Doubting Thomas might have been a cousin. I thought I read that somewhere. I don't remember. Let me ask you this. In terms of the Trinity, the Council of Nicaea in 325 established the Trinity of 3 = 1. You, I think, will agree with me that the early church did not have a very clear concept of the Trinity.
What they had was a concept of three aspects of the divine that were at work. But they did not have a philosophically worked out in technical language definition of the Trinity. You're absolutely right.
I mean, you don't see that in any of the Gospels. You don't see this,
what you see is the idea of text where it suggests that Jesus is being worshipped on a par with God, again, because of his position at the side of the Father. You see this in a book like Revelation. You see the idea of Jesus sending the Spirit, which he calls the Holy Spirit, which is seen as being very connected to who God is and what God is doing. In other words, you see elements of this. You see baptism in the name of the Father, Son, and the Spirit, so that the authority is shared between the three of them. So what you see is this, if I can say this, this triplicate language, okay, which is operating, again, with these divine prerogatives. And then what happened in Christian theology was when they tried to put this all together and say, what is going on here, that coalesced into the philosophical language that became the doctrine of the Trinity and was formalized, as you said, in the early 4th century. But the
Dr. Buckley,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that our time is about to close. I want to do a few things. First of all, I really want to thank you for having this discussion, for doing so respectfully. I've tried to be respectful myself, even though
You've
we disagree.
Great job.
I think it's fair to argue these points. I mean, people have been killed over these points for generations.
And that should
it's
never
nice
happen.
And should never have happened.
That's
people
right.
have disagreements with regard to religion. They should be able to openly discuss them without, you know, it reminds me of the people that got so upset when, you know, the Prophet Muhammad was in a cartoon that they started killing people. Whatever your religious views, it's not worth killing people.
Yeah,
I want to thank you for
this.
This
is the right kind of political correctness, the kind of conversation that we've had in the last hour, just calmly with interacting with one another, asking our questions, learning about our traditions, et cetera. This is what I consider to be healthy dialogue. It puts us all in a better position to understand one another better.
And now I want to ask you a favor. My show is ending, but the show that follows, which is Bob Kincaid's show, he would like to continue this discussion if you have some time to do so. I've actually kept my listeners at bay because I wanted to get our discussion out there. They have some calls. Do you have some more time to spend with me, or are you done for the
show? No, I could probably hang around for about a half hour.
Okay. All right. Let's conclude this show of the Inside Scoop. Let's give Bob a chance to rev up his show and also give listeners and Bob a chance to question our guest. We'll be right back after this. But for now, this is the end of the Inside Scoop. Thank you all for listening.
Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!